Tala Falava, and welcome to the Global Bus Figure Success Podcast. I'm Andrew Fa'avali, your host. Every week I'll be chatting with successful Pacific people from across the globe, unpacking their stories and, more importantly, picking out insights, lessons and golden nuggets you can use to live your best life too. All right, welcome back to the show. How cool was Lisa Tai's story last week? So good to see the Rotuman community jump in and congratulate, praise, and acknowledge her for her success, and to see just how proud they were of her especially. This week we've had heaps of feedback through our social media platforms and even by email. Thank you so much. It's always great to know people are listening and knowing what you enjoyed, and what you want more of is really important. So please follow us on Insta, Facebook, and Twitter at the Global Bus Figure Success Podcast. This week we have David Solomon on the show, and David's a former rugby league pro who played in both the NRL and the UK Super League, and who upon retirement took up a role as the Wellbeing and Education Officer for the NRL. It's a critical role that supports our elite athletes off the field with post-career pathways, and also in a pastoral role, a role that really requires expertise, empathy, and a whole lot of listening and caring. And so David's the right dude for that. To highlight just how much he gives, David's currently in camp offering support to the New Zealand Warriors in Tamworth, New South Wales. So he's been away from his family for the past 4 to 5 weeks. And for those of you who don't follow rugby league, the New Zealand Warriors have made a huge sacrifice as a team to relocate to Australia while the COVID restrictions are in place, and are currently based in country New South Wales, really far from their family, their kids, their parents and networks in order for the competition to continue. Unfortunately, they've lost most of their games this year, so that must make it tough in camp, and morale must really be low, especially with the separation from family, etc. But to compound all that, it must have been a tough week for you Warriors fans, because this week the coach was sacked and had to leave camp. Can you imagine? There's been a lot of controversy around that sacking, and a lot of banter as well. And something I see a lot that is inevitable is that the losses and the poor form is blamed on what people call bro culture. And this bro culture term really irks me as a term, because it's an insidious way to bring race and ethnicity in as a reason for losing. So the players at the Warriors are often called too laid back, or even worse, lazy. And they're often said to lack the mental toughness to manage a game and close it out for a win. And these, to me, are all slights on the racial makeup of the team, because most of them obviously are Māori and Pacific. But the flip side is that when a team with predominantly Māori and Pacific players are winning, the wins are often put down to skill, hard work, systems and coaching, as opposed to the bro culture. The bro culture only seems to be associated to when brown teams are losing. And if we have a look at that through the lens of the other code, rugby, the All Blacks are said to be the winningest team in sporting history. And lately, the All Blacks have been predominantly brown. In particular, the Brains Trust, or the halves, have also been brown. So Aaron Smith, Richie Mo'unga, Lima Sopoanga, TJ Perenara, Bulu, they've been managing the team, and yet we still get people banding around the fact that we can't play those positions and we should just stay as the forwards who cart the ball up and who are the tough dudes, or the wingers, usually Fijians, who finish it off at the end of the line. But brownness is rarely, if ever, raised as a reason for the All Black success, because it just simply won't fit the narrative. And this is one of the reasons why I really wanted to make this podcast, because it's true that whoever holds the pen writes the story, and consequently the stories you tell is the culture you create. So to all your little mongrels out there blaming bro culture for the Warriors' poor form, I hope you blame bro culture when the All Blacks win, for fairness sake. In saying all this, and in a positive ending to this little rant, I'm looking forward to when teams like the Warriors embrace and see the value in the intersections of organisational culture, but also Māori and Pacific cultures. I think that when they set their organisation up to reflect their environment and their player base, rather than how the Australian clubs before them were set up, I think we'll send an end to the Warriors' long-suffering. It's really hard to be someone you're not and something you're not. And I think the organisations are set up on a system that has been transplanted and transported and doesn't really fit the context of New Zealand. And I've got to finish off by saying my grounds for expertise of this comes from being on the bench for the Marirua Marlins from under-7s to under-12s. Anyway, back to the show. That rant just shows how important people off the field such as David Solomona are to a team and also to our community. So let's find out more about David. I started off by asking David about his childhood.
Born and raised in Greyland, one of four boys. And I pretty much grew up with my whole family. My grandparents bought a house in Greyland in the 70s. They moved from Ponsonby, where they moved to when they moved from Samoa, and then they went on to buy a couple of houses right next to each other. So I grew up with a whole heap of family, with my dad's mum and dad, my dad's siblings and their kids as well. So I had a pretty cool upbringing with my brothers and all my cousins, and just all boys, to be honest. It was my dad had 9 brothers and 3 sisters, and I think the first 12 kids were all boys. So I grew up with a whole heap of boys. Yeah, a boy growing up in City Auckland, like a lot of Samoans were back in the day. So that's my history growing up.
So City Auckland, that's close to town. Many people will know, but some won't, that a lot of those people from Central Auckland moved out to land further out just because they could buy their houses. So South Auckland and West Auckland further out is highly populated with Pacific people, and Central Auckland is now really, really prime real estate. Did you guys stay or did you guys go? Because our family started in Kingsland and then we went to Otara and then ended up in Manurewa. What about you guys?
Yeah, my parents, everyone's still there. So my grandmother's house is still there, although they rent that house out.
Yeah.
So it's one of the few big 8-bedroom houses still left in Greyland. And my parents still live in their house, which is next door to my grandmother's house.
Sweet.
My dad's brothers just still live up the road. And my mum's family, majority of them are still around Greyland and that. My wife's church is, she goes to Greyland Whakasa, which is in Greyland. I'm from PFC Newton, which is in right in the heart of the city. But yeah, all the first Pacific Island churches, everything is all in this real posh area now. People came to Auckland and went to find out, oh, where's the first Samoan Methodist, first Tongan Methodist, first Samoan Congregational. They're all in these real posh areas. And you'd look at it and go, why are they there? But it was because when they first moved from the islands, these were the places that all the Pacific Islanders lived, because it was places that people weren't really keen on living because the houses were old and decrepit, and a lot of them have moved out, sadly.
So when you're brought up in a family environment like that, the houses are next door to each other and you guys go in between, is that something that you wanted to do when you grew up and had your own family?
Yeah, it's funny, man. Like I played overseas for so long. The first thing I wanted to do when I retired was I wanted to get back to be with my family. So we had a choice between moving to maybe Auckland or Sydney or Brisbane. But a whole heap of my generation of my family, my cousins and my brothers, had moved to Brisbane, and we all moved literally to the same suburb. So we've tried our hardest, actually, my family in Brisbane, to imitate what we did when we grew up. So we do exactly the same. We have Christmas together. Our kids hang out together. We do everything together. And we have formal once a month, just like our parents did, me and my cousins and my brothers. So we tried to imitate everything that was done for us when we were younger. And, I think that was because we saw how close it brought our parents, how close it brought our family. And, I feel like it's been beneficial for us moving to Brisbane just to be around everyone and have that environment for our kids as well.
You're so all doing your fitness together.
Oh, man, we got some crazy fit people, and then we've got some people who come and complain a lot, like me. So, yeah, it's awesome. It's awesome. It's funny. It's because the family that's in Brisbane, we're all the boys in the family. So all the partners are the in-laws. So we love getting together, but they love getting together and backstabbing our family. So, man, I talk about how cool it is, but I know there are a lot of my brothers and my cousins' wives are like, these guys make me sick. They want to hang out every day. And so, yeah, man, it's good for us.
At least you know that they're backstabbing, and so it's not really backstabbing.
It's hard. It's hard because my wife's the queen, so she's the leader. She's the leader of the backstabbers. So yeah, it's all right.
Just got to understand. At least you guys are together.
Yeah, I know, man.
So what about St. Paul's, man? That was a nursery for rugby league, and you came up through there, and you were one of the main players. I remember coming up. So what was going to St. Paul's like?
It's funny. My dad is the oldest out of all of the siblings, but my dad was the only one out of the siblings that was born in Samoa. And when my dad moved from Samoa to New Zealand, all my dad's siblings we're going to Mount Albert Grammar. So my dad, he come for us, and he ended up going to to Western Springs, which back then was called Seddon.
Yeah.
So my dad had no affiliation with, oh, man, I want my kids to go to Mags, whereas my dad's brothers, they were just these hardcore Mags guys. So when we were old enough to go to school, my dad said, I want you to go to a school that was a church school where you could go to school and you could pray at school. So he goes, I want you to go to St. Paul's. And to be honest, St. Paul's was just the closest school to our house. Yeah, it was a 10-minute walk from our house. And man, when I went there, I was just talking to someone about it this morning. Like, one of the Aussie boys in the Warriors team was saying, man, you grew up in grade 11. What was it like? And I said, man, I went to St. Paul's. It was 99% Pacific Islanders, and everybody walked home. Like, when I was at school in the 80s and 90s, after school, there was one bus that went to Grey Lynn. But apart from that, everyone walked home from school, man. So everyone was living in Herne Bay, Ponsonby, Grey Lynn. And I know now, you know, most of the boys have the bus in from, you know, from as far as Papakura or you know, Henderson. So growing up, you know, it was normal. Everyone grew up in the same area. Everyone grew up in Central. But sadly, that's not the case anymore.
Is it the case that we're still walking home? Are you taking your kids to school? Do they go to school around Forest Lake or?
Oh, man, I got girls, so you know, I don't even like them walking to the shop. But man, my kids are pretty lazy, man. They don't even like walking up the road. We live 2-minute walk to the shops, and they're like, oh, can you drop me off to get the milk or that? So, man, even myself, that's probably my that's one form of fitness that I do is I try and walk. But I'm not a walker anymore. Those days are over.
Man, we're kind of living in fearful times if we don't take our kids up the road. And we drive our kids, so I'm not being judgmental. I'm just saying, man, remember when we all used to walk to school, no shoes?
Oh, man. Yeah, it's funny. I went back to Auckland earlier this year and did some work for the NRL with the Warriors, and we went and done some stuff at primary schools. And, man, I went with one of the Australian guys, and they were freaking out at kids at lunchtime running around on concrete with no shoes. And I was just like, man, no health and safety in Australia. It's like, you have to wear shoes, you have to wear a hat. In New Zealand, it was just like, just if you stub your toe, don't cry. So, yeah, man, gone are the days of walking everywhere and being used to being out of the house. But I'm definitely trying to be more conscious of, you know, where are my kids and are they safe in that.
So the Solomona family was always a league family, because there was Seth Solomona who played for the Kiwis and stuff like that. But did you always know you were going to play league? And what was that career through school? Because you were in the rep teams all the way through, right?
It's funny. My uncle Seth, my dad, he's my dad's youngest brother. He, you know, he was really fortunate. He played for the Warriors the first year they were there. Lived in England for quite a while and played in the Auckland teams through the late 80s, early 90s. So, yeah, man, I was pretty fortunate that I had someone like him that lived for a period, lived in the same house as us.
Mm.
And then even one of my dad's other brothers, Fou, my uncle Malo Fou, he was the first Tor Samoa captain. So he captained the very first Tor Samoa captain. And I think 4 of my dad's 7 brothers played for Samoa. So, you know, I had a lot of uncles that were league players, but myself, I wasn't a rep player. I'd never played any rep teams. It wasn't until my last year of school that I actually make a team, and it wasn't through my club team. It was only through playing at school. So for me, I was a bit of a late bloomer. It wasn't something that I always thought, oh, man, I'm going to be a football player when I get older. But, yeah, I'm very blessed that it was, because my attention to detail at school wasn't the greatest, man. So yeah, very, very fortunate.
You came out and you played Warriors 19s. Well, did they have a Warriors 21s then, or was it just Warriors 19s and then?
Nah, so yeah, the first year I was there, there was no competition at all. So they were trying to get a competition in Australia. They ended up having a team, but we ended up playing against the second grade in Auckland. And then the next year, Super League came in and we had our Warriors under 19s.
Oh, yeah.
That team was captained by Monty Beefham. We had guys like Ali Lautiti in that team. And, you know, I went from, you know, 2 years struggling to make my local club team to, you know, playing in this Warriors team. And for me, I was real fortunate that when I got a bit older, I ended up making these rep teams.
And how come you didn't stay around with the Warriors and you shot off to Sydney to play?
And so, oh, man, it wasn't a case of how come I didn't stay. It was like I was pretty much shown the door at the Warriors. So, yeah, my last year, 1998, it goes back to 1997. So 1997, I was at the Warriors, played the under-19s team. I was really fortunate at the end of the year to get player of the year for that team. And then they signed 3 juniors to their squad. But what I did at the end of that year is I actually went to, I was going to go sign at Melbourne. So I flew to Melbourne with my uncle. I was going to sign at the Storm. It was a new club. They hadn't signed anyone. They had signed, I think, like four players at the time. And I went there. And one of the big things was that I had just started dating my girlfriend, who's now my wife. And I was like, oh, man, I don't want to leave. Like, I don't want to go live in Australia. I want to stay here. So I ended up coming back and kind of asking the Warriors, can I stay? And so that last year I ended up staying at the Warriors, but I trained full-time, did everything full-time. But, yeah, I was almost treated like an outcast at the club, man. I didn't get invited to team photos, didn't get, like, team jerseys like everyone else. And so, yeah, and the coach that was there at the time, he just didn't really like me. So when they needed players, they actually started – picking players outside of the full-time squad. So some guys who weren't even training full-time were picked to play in games. And I just thought, man, if I stay here, I'm not going to get to play. So I was in that squad with guys like Monty, who that year, Monty didn't get picked for a game either. But then Monty went on to captain the club like 2 years later. So, sometimes I think it was a case of the coach just didn't see the value in me and didn't see the value in people like, say, Monty and that. And for me, leaving was probably the best thing I ever did.
So how do you handle that? Because 97 team, didn't you guys win the Super Grand Final?
We got in the final. We lost to Penrith, yeah. So Penrith had, man, they had an awesome team. They had the Pulitua brothers and Reese Wesser and all that. All these guys that had gone on to win a Grand Final later. But it was weird. In 1997, the Warriors under-19 team and the Warriors reserve grade both made the Grand Final. But I just think the mentality back then at the Warriors was we need to buy older players and we just keep them. And they probably had the best group of junior players back then when I was there coming through the ranks, and they just no one got a shot. I remember probably the best player, one of the best players for my age group was Jonga Laval, and he was a fullback back then. And, I remember he played a few first grade games. I remember when Matthew Ridge came back, they literally just got rid of him and put, Matthew Ridge back in there. And they had a whole heap of guys that were at the club back then that just never got a shot. And it was tough because they were a new club, and I think they were just after trying to find quick success. But because of that, they ended up losing almost all their juniors because guys weren't happy staying and not getting a game.
If you have a look at the Melbourne Storm and those other successful teams, usually they're winning off the back of they're building a really good junior pathway, eh?
Yeah, well, man, they're a bit of an enigma, that club, man. I think they won their second year there.
Yeah.
And, man, they had guys like Matt Ruhr who come through the Auckland system and never got picked up. And, I think the amount of guys that left the Warriors from that period, from about 1997 to 2000, I went on and had pretty decent careers over in Australia. So it was tough leaving home. I don't want to leave home. Man, like I told you, I grew up in a big family, surrounded by my cousins and that, and moving to Australia was tough. I wasn't really keen on doing it, but, in the end, I look back now, it was the best thing that I did.
I know it's ages ago, but, you went from grand final loss, the player of the year for 97, then you went into a team where you felt like an outcast, and then you're pretty much out the door by 99. The thing I think about professional rugby and rugby league is that it's a really short period to go through some really massive highs and some really massive lows. And so then it's a really good exemplar or an example or a case study to find out how do people handle these situations in life. You know what I mean? So what do you reckon, how did you feel and how did you get through that?
Yeah, I don't know, man. How did I get through it? I think it helped that I never had this long-term dream in my life to be a football player. So when I did get in that environment, it was kind of like, for me, I was like, oh man, I can't believe I'm here. But it wasn't, for me at that time, it wasn't like, this is what I've always wanted to do. I've always wanted to be here. And for me, it seemed a little bit like luck. Man, I'll be honest, I had school friends that 3 years later were like, man, how are you at the Warriors? Like, you couldn't even make our school league team like 3 years ago. Now you're at the Warriors. And man, I'll be honest, I was at the Warriors thinking that myself half the time. Man, how am I here? Like, how did I get here? But, man, my family have had a lot of people who have done well in sport, yeah. And my little cousin that grew up literally in the same house as me, Marlo, ended up playing for the Warriors.
Yeah.
And my uncle played for the Kiwis. Like, these weren't people that I knew. These were people that I grew up in the same house with. Like, I grew up in the same house as two other people that played in the NRL. So, for me, we weren't treated any special, my older brother, he's the man in our house, he's the he's the boss. Like I didn't never come home and my parents were like, bro, you're the NRL player, we're gonna treat you differently. It was like, no, you're still doing the dishes with your brothers. I didn't care, you know. So for me, it was tough. I this is probably a question that we deal with a lot, talking with players, like how do you deal with the highs and lows? But you know, sometimes a bit of luck. Sometimes you know, you end up going to a club and they find value in you, and you know, sometimes it's about just being resilient and hanging in there.
So you had to leave. You went to Sydney. You said you didn't want to leave because you don't want to leave a relationship and you didn't want to leave the big family. What happened in 99? You know, how was that transition to Sydney?
Yeah, it was good, man. Like, it's funny, the Roosters, they put me in a house with these two other Aussie boys, and I lasted 2 weeks there. Like, they're saying, this is where you're going to live for the next 2 years. You're going to live in this house with these players. The funny thing is they didn't even come to the airport to pick me up when I landed. I was just lucky someone from the Roosters had come to check to see if everything was all right. And he said, oh, man, the boys are supposed to pick you up. I know where they are. I ended up going to the house and then realizing that they totally forgot. So they dropped me off to one of my schoolmates who had signed at another club over there. And I stayed the night there. And, yeah, that was my start of realizing how tough it's going to be away from my parents. And I literally showed up at my auntie's house 2 weeks later. My auntie that, oh, man, I only had briefly met here and there. And I asked her, can I live with her? And she lived about an hour and a half away from training,
yeah.
Whereas the house that I was living with was 5 minutes from training. But I chose to travel an hour and a half because at least I was with family. And for me, it was just the realization that, man, if you want to be comfortable, you're going to have to be a bit uncomfortable in certain situations. So that's what I chose to do. And, you know, it was tough at first, but I ended up staying with my auntie for quite a while.
Sydney City's got a really good culture. Well, they've shown that they've been successful over a long period of time. What do you reckon is the key to their success?
Man, I think, you know, when I was there, they hadn't played in the grand final for over 20 years.
Mm.
I think they've slowly built up a great culture at the club. Man, they've got real successful board. They've got a bit of money. They didn't stress too much about money, but I feel like as a club, winning can become habitual, you know. It's like the storm a little bit. When you're there, you feel confident just watching training, watching, you know, everything that they do. And I feel that rubs off on the players, and I think it rubs off on the opposition as well. You know, for a long time, they've been a club that people have looked at and said, man, that's a real successful club. And players have wanted to, I know for a fact, players have chosen to stay at clubs like the Roosters for less money to be successful. So, you know, they've done a lot of good things right. And I know a lot of players that have come through both those clubs, the Roosters and Melbourne, who have said, you know, really good clubs to be at. They've really looked after me and they've enjoyed their time there.
You've played a couple of grand finals, right, in Sydney? One for Sydney City and one for Para.
Yep. I played in them. That was it, man. Like,
Wait, what's that like, man?
Yeah,
you got to come away with the goods, but, man, to play in that whole build-up of that week.
Yeah, it's funny, man. You know, I tell you, like, I never expected any of this. Like, I can honestly tell you the first grand final when I was at the Roosters and played against Broncos, I might have been one of the most happiest guys on the field after the game. Even though we lost, I can distinctly remember, like, looking around and seeing, like, some of my teammates crying, but me just thinking, man, I can't believe I just played in the grand final. Like, 2 years before that, like, I was at a club at the Warriors where the coach was like, you're useless, we're not even going to give you one game, let alone let you play in a grand final. And it's funny, it's the coach of that team, Frank Endicott, he was the coach of the Kiwis. That first year, I was the only Kiwi that played in the grand final, and he still didn't put me in the Kiwis. Like, there was no other Kiwis playing in the grand final. And it was funny, the two of my teammates that I played with both were injured for most of that year, Quinton Pongi and Richie Barnett. They didn't even play most of that year, and they ended up making the Kiwis, and I didn't. So, you know, for me, it was the first year I was happy. It was kind of like I had proven a lot of people wrong. But the second year was heartbreaking. And the truth is, I've never watched both those games ever. Like, I've never watched a replay of it. And I work for the NRL now, and I work on grand final day. And I've never watched the last 2-3 minutes of a game, and I've never watched the team celebrate. And I've found it really hard to kind of like, yeah, watch it, man. Like, yeah, it's been tough.
You're a pretty laid-back dude. People are really gutted, man. People are emotional and crying and stuff like that. Do you reckon that it's just your demeanor or just your disposition that means that you don't take too much on board and you're pretty laid back?
Nah, man. I tell everyone this. I think to get to a certain level in sport, you've got to be pretty crazy. You've got to have this competitive edge to you. Like, if I'm honest, I hate losing. Like, I hate losing at anything, you know? So there's a lot that happens internally that I try to just be like, and then just go in my room and then cry in the pillow. But like my wife, my daughters, they all know, oh, man, if I beat Dad, I know he's going to be angry. So when I'm at home and, man, I lose it if I lose it at Scrabble or Monopoly or, but you know, try and be relaxed. But I've had a few times where I've lost it from losing. But yeah, like I said, I feel for most people in this environment, it's hard to keep going up in levels in regards to, you know, who you play for if you're not competitive.
It's a little bit weird to me because I remember one of my best mates, probably my best mate, he was in the Warriors, but he was up and down that 97 team. And so I used to come and watch that, and I thought you were always in the system because I thought that you were a mainstay of the system. So it's kind of surprising to me to hear that.
Are you talking about my friend Philemon Lolohia?
Yeah. The man.
Man, he had like an Italian, my friend, Philly, man. So, yeah, nah, bro, one of the nicest dudes, man, Philly, like the Tongan stallion, man. But, I'd never, you know, like guys like Philly, actually, man, he played Auckland teams his whole life, I think.
Yeah, I thought you guys were doing
always,
it together.
Always, nah, man, that Warriors team was like my first rep team, like. Like I said, the year before I stopped playing, I wasn't even playing club league. I played first 15 for the school.
Oh.
And my school's not a first 15 school, but I just decided, I'm not going to play league this year. I'm going to play first 15. And then I played New Zealand secondary schools. That's the first rep team that I made. And from that team, I got signed from the Warriors. So from one game. So I went from never making any rep team to making a New Zealand secondary schools team, which sounds amazing, but for league, it's not like rugby. Secondary schools, like, there's only a few teams that they can pick from.
It's harder now, though, because they have their nationals, and their nationals are really competitive, eh?
Yeah, a lot different now, but back then, yeah, there might only be, like, six schools to pick in New Zealand secondary schools from, so it sounds cool, but it wasn't that cool back then. Like, I think, like, 11 of the team were from my school team, so.
You left early, then you left at around 24,
25. Man, I kind of fell out of favour with the coach there, man, at Para, so. It was weird. Like 2002, I went on tour with the Kiwis.
Yeah,
went to England on a crazy. It was the last of their big tours, their 9-week tour, and then I come back, went into preseason, and then I didn't even get picked for the first two games. I think for the start of the season, and I was like, man, how did I go from like just getting picked for the Kiwis to can't even make my club team? I don't know. I think there's a bit of immaturity on my end, and I wasn't playing as well as I probably should have, and. Yeah, like the coach then, he didn't pick me, and it got to the point where I got near the end of the season and I actually asked, can I leave? So I was still on contract for another year. And it actually got so bad to the point where I didn't want to play in the NRL, like, because I just didn't want to. I just felt like it was just a lot of stress, a lot of pressure. And I actually rang up a friend who was in England, and he happened to be at a place called Wakefield.
Yeah.
And I said, is there a club there? And he said, yeah. And I go, can you ask them if they'll sign me? I didn't even ask where he wasn't even playing for where he was playing for Leeds. And that's literally how that started. So, man, I just wanted to get away from the NRL and I wanted to go overseas and I didn't care where it was. And, yeah, that whole deal for me to leave was done in, like, you know, 2 weeks, man. Yeah, it was mainly because I was, I don't know, like, league wasn't my whole life and I felt like the coach that I had, he wanted me to, like, wake up in the morning and figure about footy and, want to send me messages at night to say, are you thinking about this? And I was like, I want to say, no, not really. I'm, you know, but.
So yeah, if it again, wasn't your whole life, what were the different dimensions of your life?
Man, I've always been a church dude. So my faith had been at the top of my list for me. And man, just my family, my friends, you know, like I prioritized things that I knew were real and tangible stuff that I could engage in every day to make me happy, man. So. For me, I loved the opportunities that football gave me, but if I'm honest, I never ever found my identity being a football player. I was never one of those dudes that like, oh man, I want everyone to know me as this rugby league player, you know? And I found it hard when I was around like certain coaches who wanted me to just live and breathe football.
It's kind of similar. And is it the same class as like Ali Lauitidi?
Yeah. Oh man, Ali's case is probably more prominent because he actually came out and said that to a team manager, you know. And it's funny because guys like Ali, Mututoni, we were all together in the off-season of like 2003. And by mid-2004, we were all in England together. Wow. And I was at Para, Ali was at the Warriors, and Mutu was at Brisbane. And over that break, we all asked for a release and ended up in England together. And Mutu ended up living with me, him and his wife, Kesia, and Ali was at Leeds, which was just down the road from where we were living. So it's so funny that probably Ashri, who had similar thoughts on our football career and how we approach things, we ended up in the same place at the same time.
Given that you're working in the NRL, has footy kind of shifted in terms of coaches' approaches in terms of, you know, you got to be 100% footy? Do they understand that these other pillars of your life actually make you a better footy player? And if so, how do they implement it in the team that you're seeing?
Yeah, I think we've got a new age type of coach now. I think guys like Trent Robinson, who's at the Roosters, and then you've had people who've had that approach for a long time, like Wayne Bennett and Craig Bellamy, who you talk to any of their players and they'll say, man, this dude, he will do anything for you as a coach. Like, he's a player-focused coach. And what I mean by that was, like, I know, for instance, say someone like Craig Bellamy, the boys I know that have been coached under him, even guys that have been cut from the club, had nothing but good things to say about him, which isn't normally the case. And that was because, man, he took this interest in who you are. You know, is your mom sick? Oh, man, like, next time he sees you, he's like, how's your mom? And it wasn't always a case of, like, you know, football, football, football. I think players and coaches now have a better understanding of the embodiment of a player. You know, it's not just football focus. If you take care of this, or we'll help out with this, we'll help out with this. And all of that together, you know, makes a better football player. And I think times have definitely changed for the way that that's been approached. And coaches have done a lot of stuff on that, and players as well.
And what about faith? Because, you know, for you and Ali, faith was top of the list. How are they dealing and navigating with that, some of the coaches who might not believe in God or spiritual?
Yeah, I mean, like, the truth is that there's going to be a whole heap of people that don't care anything about what you do outside of the game. You know what I mean? They don't care how your family is. There's going to be coaches that don't care if your wife is sick, or if you've been moved away from home, or if you grew up in New Zealand and we brought you here. All they care about is, are you going to perform for me? You know what I mean? And you know, in regards to faith, I think that there's been a big acceptance of faith around the game. And a lot of the stuff that I know the game has been around, trying to do things to benefit players. Just prior to this COVID stuff doing, we were working on with the Bible Society on coming up with like an NRL Bible, themed Bible, just to help players of faith to kind of have a Bible to give out, to say, man, this is why I do what I do, and this is what's given me strength, you know. So I think the game in itself has been supportive on that. And I know some of the courses that we've done, they've tried to encapsulate everything. Like, they've brought in people from the Atheist Society and have a discussion and make that fair and make people realize that it's, you know, not just guys of faith that we support, but everyone.
Sweet. So England is cold. The north of England is cold. How did you handle all those years up there? How many years were you there?
Yeah, we were there for just over 9 years. So, yeah, we loved it, man. Like, I think growing up in New Zealand, it's not the warmest climate for, you know, a majority of the year. But I found the pressure outside, the pressure while playing and outside of the game benefited me personally. I didn't feel like there was that big pressure to be something that I wasn't. Over in England, they allowed me to be just essentially a football player, and when I'm at home, just let me be a father and be a husband and do that. So I found that was probably the reason why a lot of us went there at an early age, like Ali and Mutsu, and that went there at like 23, 24, 25 and ended up staying there for, you know, 10 plus years. I remember the Titans come over to England and had a meeting with me and Ali at the same time, and man, showed us this real cool video and living on the beach and that. Yeah. And then they're like, yeah, it's going to be amazing. And I think me and Ali had a discussion about it, and it was just like, man, I don't know if I want to go back there. You know, like, training is a bit crazy in the NRL, and the lifestyle is a bit crazy, and the pressure is a bit crazy. And I'm happy I ended up staying there. My family loved it. My wife loved it. And happy wife, happy life, man.
What would you say to people who say, but don't you want to test yourself in the toughest comp? Would you say you've already done it, or what would you say?
Yeah, man, it's probably the same thing that I say to players who ask me, who are in the NRL and ask me about, should I go play in Super League? You know, I've been offered a contract. And I think everything is dependent on what you want. You know, everyone's goals are different. You know, I was talking with some of the younger Warrior boys in the weekend saying, you know, your goal might have been just to play one game, which is great. You know, and if you've done that and you're happy with that, man, that's all good. Don't let anyone tell you that, well, you need to be doing this to be successful. You know what I mean? I think success is when you have a goal and you fulfill it. You know what I mean? And you can keep setting new goals. But for me, my happiness was a lot more important than coming back and trying to play in the NRL and win a grand final. I felt like for myself, I was able to be who I was over in England and enjoy my football. And yeah, I think just moving around a lot wasn't good for me and my family, you know. And I think a lot of people look at football and they see all the cool stuff, but man, trying to get your kids to change schools again, trying to get your wife to move, pack your house up again, a lot of that stuff takes its toll on families. And you know, I've got a friend who's the assistant coach at Souths, and his daughters have moved schools 5 times in the last 6 years. And you know, it's not all peaches and cream for everyone in this environment, you know.
Because I remember when we were talking before, when you signed on to another club, you didn't want to move town, so you used to travel and drive and then sleep during the Arvo and then train and then drive back home.
Yeah, nah, I think, so we moved to a town called Wakefield and I ended up staying there the whole time of my career, but I played for another 2 clubs outside of Wakefield, so I was lucky Bradford wasn't too far. It was on the same side of Yorkshire, West Yorkshire and that, and then I moved to Warrington, which was up past Manchester, going towards Liverpool and that, which was a fair drive. So, you know, signing at that club, I had to make the decision whether I take my kids out of school and put them in another school and sell our house and move to another house. I just decided it would be easier if I just drove every day. So, I'm one of the worst travelers as well. So I spent a lot of time complaining in the car driving up there. And getting there, training at 9:30 or 9 o'clock sometimes, but having to leave home at 6 o'clock and just to beat traffic and get there at 7:30 and go to sleep in the training room for an hour. But when I look back now, the sacrifice of doing that was a lot better for my kids and my wife, and I'm glad that I did that.
Yeah, I think I read somewhere where Joe Laval was going from Penrith on the train all the way to Manly.
Crazy.
Yeah,
man, I don't know how Joe was doing it. You know, he was playing in grand finals. This guy was playing in grand finals that year. And he was catching like 2 trains and a bus and sleeping at people's houses, you know. And people are probably going to NRL games playing, going, look at these guys, prima donnas doing this, and not realizing he was like probably sitting on the train with them in the weekends trying to get to training. So, yeah, it's lucky for some, not for everyone though.
So what about your work, man? How's your work going? You've been in the role for a little while. What are your main observations from your work?
I work in a department called Wellbeing Education, which was formerly Welfare Education. Essentially it's just working with players outside of the game. So guys who want to study, guys who have career aspirations, like getting into a trade or something. And then the care part of it, which is guys that might be struggling with any issues. My job really is a referral person, to be that person that they can come and talk to and have a chat with. And then for me to refer them on to a professional, and then, you know, in some cases there's a crisis part of it. So, you know, when there's bigger issues, going in and doing that. So I love this role. It's actually the job that I prior to me retiring, that I wanted to do. And I feel pretty fortunate that I've been able to go into it.
You need really broad skills to handle the crisis all the way to the education, employment, training, then into family support and network support. Is every day different?
Man, you're trying to make me sound like I've got this broad skill set here, but I feel like, if I'm honest, I feel like it's something that's ingrained in a lot of PI people, man. It's empathy is probably a big thing in this role, and just being able to be someone that people can talk to and then also point them in the right direction. Like I said, I feel like it was something that I wanted to do when I was playing. And I feel like it was something that I was kind of doing while I was still playing, even without knowing it. You know, when we lived in England, even though I wasn't at Wakefield, when I had moved to another club, even though I was living in Wakefield, if there was anyone that came to Wakefield to play, I'd invite them to come stay at my house. I'd say, man, you can live here. You don't need to pay any rent. We'll look after you. We'd have people over for dinner. I think we always had that, you know, that characteristic in us of being mindful of other people and looking out for other people and that. And the fact that I get to go into a job that involves a sport that I played for so long and take that into that job, it's made it a lot easier.
Yeah, I did want to talk about your broad skill set because just going back to your playing days, you played front row forward, but then you played number six for the Kiwis. That absolutely just blows my mind. And I remember we did a Q&A at University of Queensland, and I said it was like studying. I didn't even – when no. I came away from it, I said it was like becoming a professor in arts and then switching over to be a professor in medicine. But I don't even know if that really cuts it because you went from smashing straight up the middle of the field against all these massive bodies, and then you went to play with the ball. And I even mentioned there that I remember seeing in the changing room on the camera you were juggling and keeping your ball skills honed. Man, what was that like? Isn't that the dream?
You've just really – you've dug deep into your bag of
– There's no bag, man. There's no bag.
You're trying to build the correlation between me playing in the back line and me playing in the forwards is
But seriously, man, because what is it like? Isn't that everyone's dream to go from – especially front rower's dream to go from the front to running the cutter?
Well, man, there's two things about me. When I played six for the Kiwis, was one is they had to reorder a bigger jersey because the jerseys they had were all
you should have given
medium,
you 16.
Medium, and they needed to get a free XL in there. And the second one was I only lasted about one half because after the first half they were like, "What were we thinking?" And they ended up. I remember Stacey was on the bench, and they ended up bringing Stacey Jones on to finish the game because they're like, "This guy's trying to kick past the people on the wing and throw out cutter balls."
Well, if you're given the license, man, wouldn't you just do it? But what did you think going in? Like, was that an affirmation of how agile you were and the skill set that you always believed you had?
Nah, I don't know. I think it was, you know, when you have training runs and you try and be the guy that's going to, man, run off me, do that. You think you're having fun at training, and the coach is probably there like, man, this guy can actually, I think he might have a go at six, man, but.
I wasn't
that guy, man. Definitely not. It's a bit different. It's like I wish it was like rugby where I could play front row and scrummage and that and then go and play first five, but
it's still pretty amazing.
League's different, man.
But I still see like Tohu Harris do it and even that dude John Asiata from the Cowboys.
Oh, but there's this young kid at the Warriors, a Tongan kid named Tom Ali. And I think he played second five for Rotorua Boys. He trains on the wing and then he trains it at prop and can train at centre. When I first saw him, I was like, his body type was like, looks a little bit like a prop, but then when he runs, it's like, oh, he's a winger. So, man, it sounded cool back in the days, but these days you don't know who plays where. Everyone looks the same, man. They're like the Fijian Sevens team. You don't know who's the lock and who's the winger.
Well, that just makes your time and the time that you went from prop to six even more remarkable.
Thanks for bringing that up.
That's
though,
remarkable,
man.
Mate.
I need to let some people know that.
Oh, everyone's got to know. I'll be telling everyone. I played front row and number six for the Kiwis.
I need to find that jersey with the double stitching on it, man. They said cut that jersey up and cut that jersey up and then put that in the middle and then we'll get it, man.
At least they gave it to you. They didn't make you play in the eight at six because then it doesn't really feel as real.
Yeah, I know. It was, I don't know. I still don't know what happened there. We won, though. That's the main thing.
Hey.
Yeah. Anyway.
Oh. So, yeah, man, a lot of people would be interested in this. You know, mental health's a big thing that everyone's talking about, especially right now where Black Lives Matter is the agenda going around at the moment because of some, you know, police brutality. And then COVID just hit. How are the Warriors there in Tamworth? Man, it's a big call to bring them out from their families. You've already explained how important family is as a support factor for pro footy players. They're in country New South Wales. Right, what's your role in this process, man?
Man, yeah. So, man, the one thing about my job is that I have no say in football, man, which is one of the reasons why I've always wanted to come into a role like this. I've never had this urge to become a football coach, a trainer. I've always wanted to work around clubs, but I have no interest in the actual game. Yeah, like I said, I think I've only gone to seven games in the last 7 years, and five of them were the grand finals because I work at the games. But it's tough, man. It's tough being around the club, and you know, when the boys lose, it's hard, man. You know, I know. You know, you go on social media and people will write stuff, but when you're actually in this environment, you're around the boys. Man, they're real people, real lives of real families, and you know, real partners. Real, they've got mum and dads who read that stuff, and you know, it's tough being here. Like, I think more so also for the boys being away from their families, it's a big sacrifice. And then on top of that, there's been restrictions placed on the boys in regards to only last week where they're allowed to walk outside of this resort that they're at, man. So. You know, the place that we're at's really nice. Like, everyone's really grateful to be here. But, you know, you'd rather stay in a one-star apartment and have your family with you than stay in a five-star resort and have to call your kids every night. And, you know, we've had a few guys whose kids have done their first thing, like first word, first talk, and they're over here. And it's been hard. But, you know, sometimes it's a sacrifice you've got to make to provide for your family.
Is it actually a bubble, and does it actually heighten, you know, the down buzz that you get when you lose, because then you don't have a total separation, because you could probably go home and your kids, they don't really care about your footy, but when you're staying in that resort, you're looking at your teammates who you're on the field with and who are in the team meetings with and stuff. Is it kind of heightened risk?
Yeah, man. You sound like someone who knows a lot about, man, sport. It's true. Like, it heightens it being in here. It's an actual bubble. For the first 2 weeks I was here, and they were in 2 weeks quarantine prior to me coming in, we literally weren't even allowed to walk outside of this resort. You were supposed to go to training, come back and go to your room and stay in your room. And they did that for 2 weeks. Weren't allowed to visit people in other rooms.
What?
And it was tough, man. Like, for me, working in the space, the win against St. George, I was happy because, man, it's a big sacrifice. Like, you know, we got people who are introverts and live by themselves, and having to live in an apartment with other people who may not be cooks, may not clean. I don't know. Some guys get frustrated being in that environment. So it was really hard. And, you know, the NRL have allowed the players to walk outside and go across the road. There's a park there. But even then, you've got to be really careful where you go, and it's only for a certain amount of time. But it's changed a lot. So, this environment, I tell everyone, it's not for everyone. It's a highly competitive environment where you don't tell people all the time that you're injured. You don't tell them that you're sick.
Mm.
You're trying your hardest to be the best you can be, and trying to do that while abiding by these protocols and being away from your family. For everyone, it's different, but it's tough. Yeah, it's tough for everyone.
So credit to the Warriors, because if they didn't make it over, then the competition would be totally out. But it sounds like it's not actually a level playing field, especially for the out-of-towners who have to come in and be away from their families.
Yeah, at the moment, man, it is. It definitely is. You know, it's you know, there's 15 other teams who, when they finish the game, they can go home and hang out with their wife and their kids and spend a bit of time there and sleep in their own bed. And then there's another team here at the moment who are staying in apartments with their teammates and, you know, do it away from their families. But no one in here is complaining about that sort of stuff. Everyone understands the situation that we're in, and everyone's trying to do their best to, like I said, man, put themselves in a position to win games and know that they're doing this to provide for their families.
How is it for you in that environment? Maybe a few years ago, maybe about 4 or 5 years ago, there was some suicides in the Pacific community from some budding NRL players and that. Everyone's got an opinion and everyone's got a solution. How is it for you, man, when they're coming to you and what are you guys doing and just offering their opinion in good faith and with good intent, but it must get tiring.
Yeah, it's hard, man. Like, I know working in this environment, you know, you're going to be held to a different standard than everyone else. I've read articles on guys that left, that played under 20s and like, 2011, four games, and I've seen articles with the headline "Ex NRL Star Commits Robbery," and it's like, man, he played a bit of league like 8 years ago, and you know, I feel like the game has a responsibility to speak up a lot more on social issues such as suicide and that, and I feel like we don't always do that, but also because you're held to a higher standard, I think that we need to do more to help our players, but and saying that the game does do a lot. You know, it's one of the few sports across the world that I know has full-time well-being people at clubs, that has programs in place, has like a database that checks up on players, make sure that there's certain criteria that we have to meet, standards that have been put forward by a committee and that. But it's not as simple as that as well. You know, you might have a kid who's grown up in an environment for the first 18 years of his life and come into the game, and when he's 20, he might have an incident in the game, and people are like, "Oh, what's the game done? The game's done nothing to help this. What are they doing?" And it's like, man, there's certain amount of influence the game can have on players, but we can't control everything. But I think we do have responsibility to say more and do more if we can.
What about social issues? Do you think that sports players should be held up as role models for social issues and advocates for these different things?
Yeah, I do, man. 100%. Yeah. No question. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think if they can handle it with mana, if they're ready and equipped for it, if they've got the support for it, I think so. I think they're thrown as role models just because of the success that they've had in one field. And so providing that support. But how has the game evolved or devolved since you played?
Yeah, no, I think 100% the game's evolved since I played. Like there was no one really working in the space 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And now the game, I think, employs over 70 people across the game working in a wellbeing education space. So there's a lot happening in regards to making sure players are doing stuff right outside of, you know, just training and playing games. And then on top of that, doing stuff with players that have relocated and, you know, making sure they do their best there. But, man, there's always going to be cracks in that as well. And there's always going to be clubs that are going to cut corners and try and do things differently. And there's always going to be players that are going to be unhappy. And if there's players that are going to be unhappy, there's going to be families that are going to be unhappy as well. So, you know, I think as a game, if we can try our best to keep doing stuff the right way, we'll start having players come out of the game in a better position than when they came into the game. But, I work for the NRL. I'm not the spokesman for the NRL. There's still stuff that I feel like as a game we can do. But I definitely think the game's evolved 100%. And, you know, I know that they've gone to conferences like PADS conference, which is overseas with NFL and NBA and that. And, you know, a lot of those sports have looked at the work that the NRL has done and said, man, these guys have ahead of a lot of other sports across the world.
Yeah, shot, and credit to you and your team for leading the way and making sure you get the best evidence. Bro, just to kind of turn it down, who is your favourite coach and why?
My favourite coach, probably my last coach, man. His name's Tony Smith. So the coach that had me when I was at Parramatta that kind of like done my head in was Brian Smith, who was his brother.
Oh, they're brothers.
Yeah, they're brothers, man. So, man, Brian Smith, shout out to Brian Smith, is the smartest coach I've ever had. Like, man, like to this day, like stuff that he's taught me, I still think about it all the time, you know. There's little habits that he had ingrained in me. But his brother Tony Smith was my favorite coach just because I think I was just a lot older when I had him. I was in the last stage of my career, and he treated me like I was a friend as well, man. And he took a big interest in who I was as a person. And he was one of the reasons why I ended up wanting to have a job like this, thinking about guys, not just as football players, but people.
And favourite player to play alongside?
Heaps of dudes, but, man, I'm a massive Ali Lautiti fan. Man, and Tony Politua, you know, I like those two. Joe Ngalavau, another dude, Leslie Vanikolo, but, man, a lot. I'm a big fan of all my mates that from Auckland, man.
And then the one that you enjoyed playing against, lastly,
Clinton Tupi was at the Warriors. Still real good friends of him now. He's probably the most annoying dude I ever played against. He's one of those dudes like he's your mate, but bro, like if he gets a chance to break your arm on the field, he'll try and break your arm, and then he'll be like, "Yeah, I got you, punky." And then after the game, he goes, "Oh, some sorry, you." So I never mean it, but.
Well, I reckon that's exactly what you're like.
Nah.
Oh, come on.
Nah, I'll break his arm, but while I'm doing it, I'm like saying, I'm sorry. I'm not going to be a man. Yeah. Nah, that's not me, bro.
Ah, shot, man. Thanks, bro. I can see, like, the thing that pierces right through your life is that family is critical and that hospitality and empathy is critical. You're going from living in central Auckland in houses next to each other to Forest Lake here in Brisbane. But even when you mentioned over in Wakefield, you brought people in and you're hospitable to them, and now you're in a job and a vocation that satisfies that need for you to, you know, just to help people and help people through, especially through tough times. Bro, you're in a really important position, so we wish you all the best and thank you for everything that you've done, especially in the NRL well-being and education space. Do you have any, one piece of advice for up-and-coming rugby or rugby league players, especially of Pasifika descent?
Man, this is something I ask all the time, man. Like the two things I normally say to players is be coachable, you know, be the type of person that's willing to learn and be like a sponge. And the other thing is to get into good habits, especially for our people, man. Mm. Like, man, get into the habit of eating right, you know, sleeping right, being around the right people. A lot of that stuff's hard to try and do when you become 18, 19, you get into the system if you've never done it before. If you've got kids that you want to succeed in any area of their life, get them into good habits early, financial habits, you know what I mean? Like, critically thinking about doing stuff the right way. Mm. So when they actually get put in an environment where they have to start doing stuff themselves, they're used to it.
And there you have it, David Solomona, former NRL and Super League star. I really love the advice he gave at the end there, and I know that it's advice that he not only preaches, but he also practices. I actually meet up with David regularly. There's a crew of four that we have that support each other and just get together and check in on each other every couple of months. So shout out to Lausa, Ili and Ati Mamua, the other half of the crew. And I know that if we set a time to meet for coffee or lunch, that they would not only be there on time, but he'll be there early. And I think that's just one of many habits he picked up throughout his football career, and that has led to his success off the field post-career as well. Not only that, but I just know that David is a man of integrity, he's a man of faith, he's a family man, he's a husband and father to his wife Utu, and has been blessed with three daughters. And whether on the field or off the field, he's a role model and mentor to many. So great to have a chat to him. It's a real pleasure to bring you his story. Next week, we have Karina Lyons, former diplomat and consul general to Hawaii, and also ambassador to Marshall Islands, Federated States of Micronesia and Palau, and currently the vice president and director of research in Hawaii of the East West Center, a lady who has an inspiring story, who's been all around the globe and kicked the butt in many spheres, so can't wait to bring you that one. But in the meantime, have a great week. Take care. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe, please, on our podcast platforms. And God bless.